Oh, hi, podcast listeners. There's many ways you can listen to the Real Nerds Podcast. You can subscribe on iTunes. You can also subscribe on Stitcher Radio. You want to send us a Twitter message? You can do that. It's so easy, at Real Nerds. Like us on Facebook, Real Nerds Podcast. You can visit our website, realnerdspodcast.com, where there'll be a lot of articles for you to not only read, but to listen to our previous shows. Do you like your stories told through pictures? Then you can also follow us at Real Nerds on Instagram. You can also call us, 720-6NERDS5. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Camera, action!
Well, a real nerd knows who shot, and a real nerd can follow the plot, and a real nerd
doesn't
can...
Doesn't talk film! I'm sorry.
Take it outside.
Well, a real nerd knows who shot, and a real nerd can follow the plot, and a real nerd will give it all they got. Lights, camera, action!
Welcome to Real Nerds Podcast, the best movie podcast in the world and of all time. I'm your host, Brad, and with me is a co-host you have not heard in a while.
Zach Eastman, hello.
Welcome back, dude.
Hey, yeah, it's been a minute. It's been a minute, buddy. I've been stuck in Golden Age Hollywood land so much, I needed to come up for air to talk about some summer blockbusters, you know?
You saw a little smidge of color on the horizon. You're like, what's that? I got to explore that. What is that?
It's like the end of Nosferatu. Instead of like a beam of sun, it's just a rainbow that comes at me. And I just go.
There's a three-dimensional world out there.
Oh, my God. You mean nobody is in monotones and nobody has shades of gray on their skin? Oh, my God. I've missed so much.
So, yeah, Ryan's working, but I think he's going to call in his review. I don't know. People keep telling me they're going to call in reviews, and then they never do. So, who knows? He'll probably just show up next week and talk about this movie.
I'm Ryan. Apes are cool. They were awesome. I liked them.
Wow. Brilliant insight, Ryan. Thank you. If you've never listened to Real Nerds before, what we do is every week we go see a new movie, and we podcast that experience the world. I think I just said at the beginning, can you tell I haven't hosted in a long time? So this week we saw Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. We'll talk about that immediately. And then the rest of the show will be us talking about movie news and what other things we've been watching throughout the week. So let's get into it.
All right.
Zach, what did you think of Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes?
Thought it was good. Very, very good. I've been a fan of the reboot trilogy that they had put out between 2011 and 2017. And so the fact that they're picking the ball back up under 20th Century Studio auspices, I was worried that it may not, you know, be as innovative as what they were pulling off. But I was pleasantly surprised. I have a couple of issues, but nothing that would deter me from ever watching it again. Ultimately, as long as you've got talking apes and apes on horseback and apes dealing with those damn dirty humans, I'm on board, you know. So yeah, I recommend people check it out, but we'll get into it more in the plot spoilers because there's a lot to talk about.
I think I've been famously vocal on this podcast about not being interested in these movies that much, and I've basically seen so many movies in the theater lately that I have no choice but to see everything because there's like nothing left. But I was blown away by the trailer. The CGI just is incredible. And so I gave it a shot and I thought it was awesome. Not the most complex movie, but still just the CGI alone was like, I can't believe we're at this level and there's other movies still racing to catch up, you know, the work on this is just phenomenal. The story is pretty, pretty decent, compared to everything else that's out there right now. So I was impressed.
Wonderful. And
here's the trailer for Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
Are you familiar
with the concept of evolution. In their time, humans were capable of many great things.
Noah!
They could fly like eagles fly. They could speak across oceans. But now, it is our time. And it is my kingdom. We will learn. Apes will learn. I will learn. And I will conquer.
Legend says, ape and human live side by side. Impossible as that may seem.
Why do they hunt her?
She's smarter than most.
The elders did not tell us everything about this world.
Bend for your king.
Apes hunt humans. That is wrong.
So yeah, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes introduces us to a new hero, Noah, and his other ape buddies, who are just living a peaceful life in the Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes until things go wrong. another tribe wanders in and destroys their village, kills Noah's dad, and then rides off with slaves for their own kingdom. And then Noah vows revenge. And so he goes on this quest to find this other village and rescue his family. And he grows and learns along the way.
Yeah. The key plot point that motivates the other, motivates Proxima Caesar's drive is that they're actually searching for a human who has the knowledge and wherewithal of a human bunker, basically a government bunker. And this is the character of Nova, or as she's actually named, May. I actually love that joke from Raka, which is just like, I call her Nova. We call all of them Nova.
Yeah.
That was a nice dig.
So I guess this takes place, I'm assuming, I haven't seen the other ones, after Dawn, but before the Charlton Heston Planet of the Apes?
It takes place after War for the Planet of the Apes, the final one. Dawn was the middle entry. Okay. It was the Dark Knight trilogy. It takes place generations after. You know, it's funny, you're bringing up the original 1968 version. I've been a fan of the Planet of the Apes franchise since childhood. Tim Burton's remake withstanding, I guess. And so one of the things that I liked about the reboot trilogy was that they weren't necessarily trying to dovetail into the original's arena per se and do a full on remake. But there's some setup for what could happen by the very end of this. And what it says at the top is that it's many generations afterward. The theory that I've been reading online is that it's about 300 years after the War for the Planet of the Apes, which would explain how there's a whole massive tribe of humans that has gone feral. There's a little bit of inconsistency because, I guess I would want to know, as an ape fan, how come this group of humans has gone feral and or devolved, whereas May and William H. Macy's character are still intelligent? Like, what's the division of tribes? And the only thing that stops me from going into plot hole territory or truly toxic fanboy territory, I guess, is that just like in Beneath the Planet of the Apes, there's a whole mutant society in that movie that's been hanging out in the ruins of old New York. So there's the precedent for some tribes of humans still existing out there with intelligence. And this, the way this plot breaks down, if I had one complaint about the story, I feel like it's that May is a little bit underdeveloped as a character. I love the concept of the Nova character not being a mute, feral beast, and that she's capable and has agency. I just feel like her motivation is a little underdeveloped, and I don't know if that's because they're setting up her to return in the sequel. But it just felt like a little bit, she's very much there to explain why we need to go into this human bunker and why we need to stop Proxima Caesar, who is this bonobo ape that leads the cult of the clan that kidnapped Noah's tribe. And so I feel like there's some stuff that I hope gets fleshed out in another film. But if the goal is just to create its own contained film, they do succeed. It just has a little ebbs and flows. I will say, though, there's something that I loved about this as it pertains to the original Planet of the Apes is, number one, they do set up the idea of Fort Wayne, Indiana, which is where Charlton Heston's Taylor character is from in the original film. So it's possible that the Taylor character does exist. He may have just returned on a different side of the globe to be in the film. I don't know. We'll see. But also the sound design in this film has so many homages to the original Planet of the Apes, whether it's the score itself, when they do the human hunt in the river, instead of just in a cornfield, they use that same music cue. And then they use this not cornfield, but a wheat field of sorts to do some of the same tricks that they do in the original human hunt in Planet of the Apes from 1968. But also when they go into the bunker, when the I think it's Noah and his pals go into like a nursery care unit for whatever this government facility was, they pull up a doll, and the doll has the exact same mama sound that was used in the original Planet of the Apes. I got a little kick out of that. It was really funny. In terms of the visual effects work too, I want to say, it's a mean feat. This looks even better than Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which I rewatched to gear up for going to this. The effects work has come so far with this original concept of these apes are motion capture now. It's no longer, you know, John Chambers' makeup. I was stunned.
Yeah, I've only seen Tim Burton's Apes and then Rise and then this one. So I was the whole lore and everything, all I know about the original Planet of the Apes is just through parodies. So I kind of got the feeling that this is all like a setup to bring
I didn't mean to interrupt, but I was gonna say, I'd wonder how much you'd like the original Planet of the Apes, because like it's sort of like Soylent Green for some people, where like, okay, I already know the twist, I already know the pop culture references that have been extended off of it. Like, you can almost like have a fun laugh your butt off time with the original Planet of the Apes if that was how you so choose to first experience it. The makeup was innovative for its era, but it definitely aged, obviously, compared to what Tim Burton's Rick Baker makeup had. The sprawling detail of this most recent entry is immaculate. It's probably the best visual effects work I've seen all year, period.
Yeah, because in addition just to like the apes themselves, like they have these sprawling cityscapes that are just like, yeah, there's no way they filmed this. This is all just a completely computer generated vista.
Agreed. There's also the ideas of they're doing these digital map paintings, especially near the beach, near Proxima Caesar's kingdom. And it just felt, it felt organic. It didn't feel like a CG backdrop in the immediacy. And I can see that they're using some kind of live action blended set to give it that scale and scope, which is what a map painting should do. The performances in this are fascinating because I don't know if you had followed that reboot trilogy from Rise up to War, but the first thing that I had to get used to was the fact that these apes can now speak a lot more frequently than in the original reboot trilogy, where there was a combo of light speech but a lot of sign language, because that was the way they got around the idea of apes talking early on. Once I settled into it, I really enjoyed watching them perform it with this sort of there but not quite there intelligent speech that would become the staple for the original series starting in 1968, which is these apes are speaking just as humans do. And like the villain Proxima Caesar is such an amazing performance that Kevin Durand makes. He's truly menacing. He's truly terrifying. And I feel like this film does manage to do something that the reboot trilogy wasn't always adept at. I think it does do this, but it has its ups and downs with it. Is I do think that there was an attempt to kind of speak to a more modern issue, which is what the Apes movies were good at doing if done correctly. There's a timeliness to the theme, to its themes of, you know, like following a corrupt leader of this kind of sort, or you know, blindly following in worship of this one ape, or distorting the teachings of the original Caesar, which was Andy Serkis's character. There's a lot.
I think that's the most obvious thing, was that, like, hey, you know, they've grown up with that based on this legend, and there's been no one around to prove. So people have been twisting his teachings for their own benefit.
And I feel like that's one of the reasons why it got a lot more points from me than it might have if it just been a kind of generic story, is that it is attempting without a full-on shove-in-your-face motif. It is attempting to speak to the modern world. And I think that that's what the Apes movies are best at, if done correctly. The original reboot trilogy did do those things, but I think it was also trying to develop its world. So I think it always kind of had a little bit of a balancing act to play with. Now that the apes can talk, now that the humans are either feral or hidden underground in bunkers as rebels, now they can kind of get more into the meatier stuff that would become the trademark of this franchise. So
it's like, hey, even the apes are screwing up their history just like humans. We're not so different after all.
Yeah. And I do think that there's I'm very intrigued by the way they ended it. I love the scene where May and Noah are talking at his kingdom after, or at his home after they've started rebuilding and stuff. And it talks about the trust issue. Can apes trust humans? Can humans trust apes? And there's that brief shot where she has a gun right behind her. They don't sugarcoat this relationship or this friendship or alliance with going like, everything's okay, you're a good human, you're a good ape. They keep the struggle in tow. So I would imagine that opens up the sequel for something incredibly interesting about their dynamic as an alliance. I think we really need to get, I'm glad we got some more guerrilla action in this entry, because the first three that came out under Rupert Wyatt and then Matt Reeves, they weren't really leaning into the guerrillas as the military division. And in this film, we definitely got that Silva character, the lowland guerrilla who fights with Noah at the end in the complex, it was nice to finally get a gorilla into the mix, because it's either been like regular chimpanzees or orangutans that have been the centralized focus. And now we've got a little bit of a nice mix up. So, yeah, it was a great film. I hope people check it out. It's fantastic. It seems to be doing well at the box office. So I think that means we're getting some more of these ape movies.
I think so.
Yeah. And I will say, with the visual effects thing, the Weta team and any additional team that was on this, like, yeah, I'm glad these movies take a while to come out, because it means that the visual effects are going to be that much richer. The idea of cranking them out for one a year, I would not want that at all. Like, they needed the time to get this detail right.
Plus, too, you know, like, in some ways they've been working, you know, they've been building on the same model for over a decade, you know, so it's like, they have a leg up compared to other movies that kind of start out from scratch.
Yeah. So, it's weird how the Planet of the Apes franchise course corrected when it started its reboot, because the original series had this innovative chimpanzee and ape makeup that John Chambers developed, where the actors could act through the mouthing and the prosthetic. But as time went on in that original series, the budgets kept getting cut, so the makeup budget started declining as well. So now the studio at the forefront of it and the production team have been fully aware that, okay, we're going to try this mocap thing. It works. Okay, now we need to keep making it good. We need to keep upping the ante each and every time, because if we don't, we're going to lose the trust of the audience. So I think it's been an intelligent decision by all creative forces in play to just keep escalating this, and to not, you know, settle on, we did it this way, let's just do it again. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Plus, I think too, like, they're able to make more of these movies because they're like, okay, we've already like laid down the basic architecture. Like, all we have to do in the next one is just like add a little bit more so that like it looks that much better. So it's almost like a good rate of return on like, hey, you know, these other movies have already done the heavy lifting. We just have to, like, you know, it's not like we have to like pour new latex and like fit new people. It's just like that model's already done. Tweak it a little more, add a little more detail. Like, it just gets better and better.
Just try different techniques of rendering out the final result. You know, the beauty of watching this film and how far they've come is when you see shots of them extending their arms out, the arm hair looks like as if they must have worn some kind of makeup apparatus on their arms along with the mocap suit. But then you look at the production photos and it's like, no, they didn't. Like, they clearly were rendering all of this in the computer. It just has gotten that good to where you are being properly manipulated into believing these are actual apes. I think that I don't think I found a single issue in the way they talk either, or the facial apparatus either. I think it just all blends so beautifully.
I guess that just leaves Ryan's review of Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. So let's roll that clip.
Hello, Real Nerds listeners. Just when you thought I wasn't going to be on this episode and Brad and Zach hijacked it, no, you can never get rid of me. I will always be there, even when they don't want me there. Oh yeah, you think that I didn't see Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes? Oh, I saw it. They just wanted to make sure that they recorded their version of it without me around, because they think of me as a threat. I'm like the Caesar of Planet of the Apes to those two guys, because they want to get their opinions in, and my opinions are so great that they just needed to have a chance without me overshadowing everything they do. I'm sorry, it's a fact, but that's how it is. When you're the best, everybody comes after you. It's like when you win a championship at a sporting event. Everybody is chasing the champion, and the underdogs are scrappy and they fight, but at the end of the day, the champion is always going to win, and he's always going to make the podcast more entertaining, more intelligent, and more everything. But let's shift gears. Let's talk about Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. I will say that this movie is pretty great
from the special effects to the acting, everything in this movie works very well. What I really appreciated about this film is how it built on the world of the previous trilogy of the Planet of the Apes and ran with it. It's the natural evolution, quote unquote, of the ape society, and how no matter how smart or how more advanced we think we are, not only as a species, but the jealousy, the bigotry will always rear its ugly head. And it's interesting to see that from a new quote unquote civilization with the apes. There's factions of the apes that are mean and just want to conquer all. And then you have Noah, who is the leader, not even really the leader, I'm sorry, is more of the vessel that you're following the story through. And his, do you call them tribes? What is a group of apes? I don't know what it's called. But anyway, his people basically live a peaceful life. They're fishermen. They train birds or birds of prey, hawks and eagles, to basically be scouts for them. But when their world is turned upside down by a warring faction of apes, Noah's journey to go save his people takes an unexpected turn, you know, when the human element shows up. And it's interesting to see how the apes treat the humans as unintelligent people, but they're shocked to learn that people not only can still communicate and talk, but are capable of great things. And underneath all of that is also people's ability to destroy and hurt not only people, but life itself. And it comes to, you know, when it comes to a head at the big ape village where they're trying to get into the vault, it's a really fascinating study of character dynamic of, you know, you have the leader of the apes, Proximus, who Kevin Durant is great in this film, by the way, but he just wants to get in that vault because he wants the weapons of war. And when Noah learns about what's in there and teams up with the humans, it's not necessarily for, in his eyes, he thinks he's helping, but the whole breakdown of the mistrust between each other and Noah and his friends learning that, yes, apes used to be confined in cages, and he's concerned about that. So he's conflicted about, should I help the humans to stop the uprising of a leader of an ape who thinks he's a god, a deity in the vein of Caesar, who's misguided? And he doesn't. He decides he's going to help the humans. And then even towards the end of the film with the mistrust is pretty nerve-wracking. And it speaks volumes to the screenplay that it doesn't give people an easy out. It doesn't really paint a villain or a hero in this whole picture, even though you want to say that Proximus is a villain and eventually the humans become a villain. But do they really? I mean, they're each trying to reach a goal of advancing each other's either tribe or species or whatever. And it's played beautifully in the film. And, you know, the last meeting between Noah and Nova, it's just well done because they don't trust each other, but they let it go. And where the story takes us is going to be really fascinating. And I hope they make another one with these characters and we get to explore this world a little more, because it's obviously setting up a conflict between apes and the remaining humans, as the humans are able to now communicate with each other towards the end. So yeah, I love this movie. I thought the special effects were great. The film was shot really well. The performances are great. So it was just cool to see. And when I saw the trailer for this film, it was one of the movies I wanted to see the most in the summer, and it did not disappoint. So that's what I have to say about Planet of the Apes. And the only other thing I'll say is I'll be back live next week. So you guys better be ready because I'm bringing my A game. You got me? My A game.
And we haven't heard it yet, so I don't know whether Ryan liked it or not, but
I did. I heard him telepathically, and I'm here to report that it was very unfair to him to say that they should just have used Charlton Heston as a CGI model throughout the entire film. I think that's a bad choice, Ryan. I don't know why you want Charlton Heston in this movie. It's perfectly fine without him.
He also said that the portrayal of the police apes was very unfair.
Yes, yes. That's I think Ryan's got this film a little twisted.
Cool. So yeah, that takes us into movie news.
It's real news.
Zach, do you have any news?
Let me pull some up because I forgot that I probably would be responsible for this.
while you're doing that, I'll just remind people that we'll be at Fan Expo Denver this year, July 4th through the 7th. We have an awesome pizza-themed booth planned, so stop on by, check us out, record with us. And also, it's almost pretty much the start of summer, and drive-ins are starting to come back. So check out the 88 Drive-In up in Thornton, Commerce City. Sorry. they're doing If and Ghostbusters this weekend. Hopefully this episode drops on time. And yeah, the Holiday Twin has a couple double features for their two screens that are pretty great. And I'll just remind people that the Esquire is probably no longer come July. So please check out what they have left and enjoy that theater while you can. This weekend, they're going to show Jurassic Park. And then next weekend, they've got The Room. And I think the remaining late nights are going to be The Cook, The Thief, The Lover, and something. I don't remember the full title. It's unwieldy. Bottle Rocket and Repo Man. So,
okay.
Yeah, and wonderful. There's at least one more Rocky Horror, which I believe I'll finally check out there. But yeah, the Room is not the last Friday because of the way the calendar lines up. It's actually the second last Friday, so the 24th. So if you want to check that out, yeah, which now I'm curious, what they're going to do for that Saturday because they don't have I guess probably nothing, but yeah. And then, of course, they'll have just regular. They're actually going to open Furiosa amidst the remaining schedule, so. Yeah, and also watch out because I'm trying to get a Real Nerds farewell screening of something happening. So be on the lookout for that because I feel like I'm only going to find out a couple days before we actually get to screen it. So yeah, come hang out for that screening. Zach, what'd you find?
All right, I found a couple of items. First of all, we must acknowledge that we lost the B movie Titan. Roger Corman passed away at the age of 98.
So close.
Probably, yeah. Missed it by that much. Yes, no, Roger Corman had passed away on May 9th. As the family said in a statement, his films were revolutionary and iconoclastic and captured the spirit of an age. When asked how he would like to be remembered, he said, "I was a filmmaker, just that." And rightfully so. He was a filmmaker. I think one of the things that Corman gets lauded for by a lot of people who aren't into B movies is that, well, he's the guy who gave Francis Ford Coppola and Ron Howard and Martin Scorsese and all those guys a chance at their first movie. But the man was a great last bastion for a lot of horror titans from the golden age of Hollywood. There's these Poe movies that he was cranking out for AIP. Not the least of which, The Raven, which is one of my favorites, where you have Peter Lorre, Boris Karloff, Basil Rathbone, all getting these chances to have a second wind or a second coming, or more Boris Karloff specifically, too. One of Boris Karloff still had a film owed to Corman on his contract, so he tapped Corman tapped Peter Bogdanovich to write a movie that ended up becoming Targets, which stars Karloff as an aging horror star whose fate kind of intersects with this this sniper killer at a drive-in. So he wove a lot of his own tales without that would be enough for a legacy in and of itself. His New World Pictures facilities put out things like Supper Party Massacre and Rock and Roll High School and Piranha. The man was prolific in so many ways. And in a lot of ways, if his work hadn't existed, you wouldn't have a room for something like Sharknado to succeed on the sci-fi bent, where, yeah, the budget's low, but the concept's goofy and wacky enough to just have fun with it. His works have been remade in various different ways. I think the most successful of them has probably been Death Race, with the remake with Jason Statham having been released in 2008. But the original Death Race gave an early chance for Sylvester Stallone to shine. It has a great performance by David Carradine in it. There's just a lot that the man gave to the filmmaking world. And by the way, Brad, this'll tickle your fancy bone. Fun fact, in the movie Looney Tunes Back in Action, directed by Joe Dante, it is clearly specified that the person directing a Batman movie on the lot of Warner Brothers when Daffy is trying to avoid Brendan Fraser, the director of Batman at this time around is Roger Corman. So Roger Corman was also a director of a Batman movie, technically.
A fictional place, yes.
A fictional place. But he clearly had a Batmobile on his set and a Batman. Daffy Duck just stole the Batmobile to go to the Duck Cave. But he's also, in Silence of the Lambs, he's the one of the FBI heads of personnel or something. Everybody who worked with Corman tended to stick him in one of their movies at some point. He'll be very, very missed. Hell of a man. I got to meet him at Comic-Con in 2010 when he was signing stuff for Shout Factory back then. And he was super sweet. Could not have been nicer. Also, I wanted to bring up, I thought this was a joke, but Slash Film is reporting on it too. There's a new Lord of the Rings movie being announced called The Hunt for Gollum.
Yep.
I don't know how I feel about it, except for the fact that Jackson and Serkis are returning. Peter Jackson will be producing it, and Serkis will be returning to star in it.
And direct it.
Yeah. Oh, he is directing it. Okay. So the quote by Jackson is, "We really want to explore Gollum's backstory and delve into those parts of his journey we didn't have time to cover in the earlier films. It's too soon to know who will cross his path, but suffice it to say, we will take our lead from Professor Tolkien." I'm not opposed to this. I guess I just was kind of shocked that Jackson would return, and I'm sort of shocked that Serkis was going to return. But I guess if he's getting the chance to direct it, then that's the motivation. I'm a fan of what Serkis did as a director for Venom, Let There Be Carnage. So I'm on board with him as a director. I'm wondering how it's going to feel, because the only other Lord of the Rings product we've been getting is Rings of Power, which I like, but it's definitively set itself as something that's technically not related to Jackson's world. And I'm excited for War of the Rohirrim, but the reason I'm excited for it is that it's animated. If it had been a live action film, I don't know if I would have been as enthusiastic about it. I don't know, Brad, you're not strictly a fan of the Lord of the Rings franchise, so I don't know if you have any stake in this or not.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like we got his backstory in the original movies. So I don't know what they expect to add to it.
I know.
The only thing I think of is, like, it creates a great opportunity to update that model and then maybe place it in a future 4K box set of the original movies.
Ah, now that would be really cool. That would be very, very cool.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, it's not the character that I would choose to play with.
Yeah. I I would, if anything, I would want to try to dig back into other side characters. Like, War of the Rohirrim is a great idea because it's dealing with the Kingdom of Rohan. I'd almost want to have some adventures with Strider before he encounters Frodo and the hobbits. Not saying you de-age Viggo Mortensen. You can maybe get an actor that kind of approximates him and can conceivably fit within that continuity. Those are ideas that I would like. It's one of the reasons why I liked in The Hobbit that they put Legolas in there, was that it was interesting to kind of watch an idea of what Legolas was before he got to the Fellowship. It's not in keeping with Tolkien's canon by any means, but it was just interesting from the movie standpoint to see that take effect. So
yeah, it's also gonna be a bummer of a story because it's you know, we obviously know it doesn't end well, but you're like, in detail, you're just gonna watch this like nice person just kind of like descend into being a piece of shit and then disappear for a long time. Huh,
that's the Joker movie. That's, and everybody loved that.
I don't know if he was like this great guy to start with, but yeah.
Well, he's
plus so two, like, are you gonna be able to sit there for 2 hours and like hear like in the other movies, it was at least broken up with like other scenes and characters doing other things. But yeah, this is gonna be like 2 hours straight of like that guy.
I mean, I will take it if given to me. I will say that something in there's something about watching him perform that character that is eternally fascinating. I would hope that it shows the decline of sorts in such a way that the voice isn't always that prevalent. But I mean, yeah, we're probably in for that. I think it's interesting to do a character study within Lord of the Rings. So, and he is the character that opens the door best for that kind of walkthrough. Cause like we've already done Bilbo's journey. We've already done a lot of side quests with Gandalf and the Hobbit to get to his point. You know, I think at this point, Gollum is probably the most likely candidate. But I don't know. Maybe this opens the door for other like solo adventures, and maybe they can take him from the untold tales that Tolkien wrote that never got published within his lifetime, but that his son Chris ended up putting out. Like maybe they're opening the door for something more larger to happen. But we'll
opening
see.
The door for the Sauron movie and the Saruman movie and the.
Saruman movie will never be made because Christopher Lee is dead, and it should never be recast because he's Christopher Lee.
We'll just use AI to recreate him.
No. We did that with Peter Cushing, and I was already uneasy about that. No. If they're alive, de-age them. If they're dead, keep them dead. Unless it's Sam Loomis in the Halloween movies, then just put a makeup apparatus on him and get a good voiceover guy, and then you're set.
Hey, if you're dead and a corporation owns you, your IP, you have no control over what they can do to you.
What studio? Studio? Do you think owns your IP, Brad? What studio owns you?
Well, they haven't scanned me yet, so nobody. Yeah.
I'm owned by a poverty roaster. I'm owned by the asylum.
I have yet to work with them, so yeah, I'm still a free man.
Okay, that's good.
Master of my own destiny.
Yeah, that's news.
Yeah, so let's find out what we've been watching. Zach, what did you watch?
I've obviously been gone for months, so I'm going to go through my entire watch list starting from July of last year up to now. No, that would be terrible. I was gone from the theaters for about 4 months because of other projects I was engaged in, that are like Benny related and podcast related. So I started catching up. So I got to catch, three key films. One was, I checked out Late Night with the Devil. I really liked it. A lot of fun. I know that film's got some contention for having used some AI We'll Be Right Back cards. I did not let that affect my ability to enjoy the film. I think it's not so much like a get in your bones, terrify you movie, but it's so good with the conceit and its idea. I think it absolutely holds to what a found footage movie can be without delving into something truly ridiculous. I think it manages its tone and its setting correctly. And I like that it's not making fun of late night shows. It's perfectly comfortable in the world of late night shows of the 1970s. And the jokes about it are laughing with the material and not laughing at it. It's not mocking its conceit. Our lead gentleman, who's been floating around the ether for years, David Dastmalchian, is fantastic in the lead. He's absolutely fantastic in this film. So if you have not watched that, it's now on AMC and Shudder, so you can check that out. I caught up with Civil War, Alex Garland's latest. I liked it fine. I think that it was biting off a little more than it could chew with its concept. It suffers from a similar issue that I kind of have with Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri in retrospect, where that film is being written by somebody from another country that doesn't fully understand the nuances of the turmoil in America. So they're missing something. But I don't think Alex Garland drops the ball completely. I think the idea of centering it around these photojournalists capturing the chaos around them was a smart idea, because then that way you can kind of be kind of an observer through that lens and not necessarily through any strong political lens. I just think that part of it also is that it kind of, there's places where it drags a tiny bit. And again, it's not fully handling the nuances of, you know, chaos in America that well, but more than ambitious effort and does more than I think any other filmmaker could probably achieve. And then I saw The Fall Guy, which I really, really loved. But Brad, I have to tell you the story of how you're not alone now, because Malia and I went with a friend of mine from the filmmaking community that got seated next to a horrible, horrible lady. She was elderly. And we were talking before the trailer started. I was telling my friend about how I had watched Kingdom of the Apes not too long before we came into this screening. And she was letting out a loud shush to us. So we all kind of quieted down. It was before the trailer. The Alamo Quiet Zone thing hadn't even come up yet. So we kept our voices quiet. We watch the trailers. We go through the movie. The same woman that was shushing us was hooting and hollering and clapping and making gross noises throughout the entire film right next to my friend. And then at the end of the movie, she flagged down the waitress and started berating her about how her order was not specifically right. It was the customer from hell. It was absolutely egregious. So you're not the only one who gets tossed next to annoying people in Alamo Drafthouse or any other movie theater. We got the customer from hell. This lady was godly terrible. I hope she's listening. And if she is listening, you're terrible. You're horrible. Don't come back to the movie theater. You don't deserve to be in there.
Well, yeah, the middle part where she's hooting and hollering, if those are just quick reactions to things, that's not so bad. But like, the beginning and the end there is pretty rude.
Yeah, and well, no, she was like over exaggerating everything. She was making incredibly distracting noises during those hoots and hollerings. Like, it was just, why are you telling us to be quiet before the trailers go off, and then you're going to make louder noises than any of us make during the entire movie? It laughing is one thing, doing a small clap one thing. She was like giving rounds of applauses, like she was just making like gross noises. The lady was just intolerable. Like, she did not fit the mold of a respectful but enjoyed Alamo customer.
Did you ever raise the flag on her? Like, get the staff in there?
No, my own anxiety doesn't compel me to ever do those things. My friend, though, devised a great idea, which was that because she was making noises, he said shush to her multiple times in a tone loud enough for her to hear, and she never flagged him. So my assumption is she got the fucking hint a little bit. But so that's more my friend just going like, I'm just going to clap back if you're going to clap. So he did more about that. The waitress who was helping us, though, she was a dream. She was fantastic. She got everybody's order in on time. The fact that she was yelled at by this woman is just unconscionable. So my girlfriend ended up staying, behind to, one of the managers know, like, just wanted to let you know this woman did nothing wrong. There's no issue. This woman next to us was being absolutely terrible. So,
like, you guys didn't just like stand up for her while she was berating her, been like, no, ma'am, you're doing fine. This lady's an asshole. Like,
I think we were trying to like, I should have probably done something. I guess Malia should have done something then, but I think my anxiety just said, like, I don't want to get in the middle of this right this second, but we got a receipt, so I know the waitress's name. So that's when we were on the lookout, and Malia let them know, like, hey, this is who, you know, this is what happened. Your waitress did nothing wrong. She's okay. So, it was just crazy shit.
I'm at the point I would just dump my drink on her. Like, oops.
I'm sure my friend who was sitting right next to her would have probably reached that point, but he was able to contain himself. So, so that's what I've been watching this week. I've watched three great movies, and I watched a terrible human being.
Well, that sucks.
Yeah.
Also,
I saw Unfrosted. It's fine. People are being a little bit too brutal on that film. But yeah, Jerry Seinfeld put his foot in his mouth. I understand. But movie's not that bad.
Yeah, I haven't seen it, but I saw his like bit on Saturday Night Live, and I was like, huh. This doesn't make you look good.
No, it doesn't. I think the film is funny, but I think it's funny if you understand some of the references that they're pulling out there. And since I'm into vintage media, that kind of worked for me. But I think the younger you go, you stray, the harder it will be to enjoy that film.
Yeah. So for me, I watched Audition again. It was one of the late nights at the Esquire. I fell asleep in it during like when it came out in 2000 or 1999. I missed most of it. And yeah, that movie is like the best part is the end, and it's a real slog to get to it. Have you seen it?
I once in film school. I don't like remember like uber loving it, but It was unique enough for me to say, like, right on, I enjoyed that. I wish I could have gone to the theater for it, because I'd love to have watched that with the crowd.
I mean, I guess, like, there wasn't, like, a big reaction from the crowd, I guess, until, like, the very end. But, it's like, God, the setup for this is just, ugh. Come on, move this along. Like, because, like, yeah, I kind of know what's going to happen. So I was just like, this is a lot of drawn-outness. Yeah.
Wonder if my experience lately doing Japanese horror films from decades past with my friend Rashmi would compel me in the rewatch to take some of those lessons and apply it to a more recent viewing, because I imagine I probably appreciate it more now than I did when I first saw it.
Yeah. Arrow had Weird Science 4K, like super cheap, so I pulled the trigger on that, and I'd only watched it like in parts when I was a kid. Like, it, you know, it was on TV in parts, or people put it on and I came in, you know, late or something. So I've never really, like, fully sat down and watched the whole thing. And woof, that is like, I think the movie that I've seen lately that has most not aged well.
Which one again? Sorry, you cut out there for a second. Which movie?
Weird Science.
Yeah.
I mean, in my head, it was like a lot more light, fun 80s romp, but like, it's just kind of gross.
All John Hughes films or John Hughes produced films, it's one of those ones that, like, even The Breakfast Club with its foul language and certain actions by Bender is somehow more like watchable than what Weird Science is. Yeah. I didn't see it until I was in high school, and I was just like, this feels weird. I'm done.
It's Weird Science, so it makes sense. But yeah, I was just like, you know, obviously I'm notoriously like in love with 80s stuff. But I was like, man, that's one that like, I guess the biggest disconnect in my head, because yeah, like it's like obviously there's like just some, you know, language usage and stuff, and like Anthony Michael Hall's performance in the like jazz club or whatever. It's just like, I don't remember the scene at all, and this is like not something I would be proud of.
General plot and conceit of the film is a problem from the get-go. So everything else on top of that is just kind of like icing on this layered cake of, oh no.
Yeah. I mean, overall, like, okay, two dudes, you know, I don't care about the science of it. Like, that's not the hang up for me. Like, it's this weird fantasy thing, but like, yeah, in the end, it's trying to say like, you know, I think there's better stories to tell people how to gain confidence. Like, and I don't think this one is a very like, the right way to do it. You know, it's not like the boys really fail or get their comeuppance for what they're doing, which is wrong. And then like other characters just disappear from the movie. Like, yeah. And it also feels like they just, scenes just jump along. Also, like there's a theatrical version and extended version on the disc, and I watched the extended one. So I don't know, maybe like, I need to go watch the theatrical because they did edit down like all this extraneous stuff that just like makes it jump around and like, huh?
I wonder if it's kind of weird because like there's every John Hughes film does seem to kind of have one element or two that hasn't aged well. Like my go-to is always One Dun Luck from I can't remember the character's name, but that it's something to that effect from 16 Candles. This Asian character that is just like a complete shit show of a character. And even when I saw 16 Candles for the first time, I'm like, this isn't appropriate.
Most of the time, I sit there going like, you know, the overall idea, like I could see this being remade and being like a lot of fun in like a modern way. Like there's a way to do this, but yeah. But yeah, it's weird. Like in the 80s, yeah, this was a big deal.
I can see why it's a unique concept. It's got all your favorite 80s stars in it. It's got a good killer soundtrack. It's like, I can understand why people enjoyed it.
I think the biggest sin for you is that they colorize Frankenstein in it.
You know, I, you know what? Fair.
I can imagine you watching and be like, egregious, in this movie.
I didn't remember that, but yeah, now I'm remembering it. And yeah, I don't really like I just don't want the entire movie to be colorized like that. That would be more my issue. If somebody said this is the definitive version of Frankenstein, I'd be like, the hell it is. But I don't know. They're using it for the film. It doesn't like, it's not the end of the world. Also, when that film was produced, that was around the time, I think, that colorized versions of black and white films was a thing that was prevalent to some degree or one another. No thanks. Thanks in no small part to Ted Turner and his wacky ideas. So,
yeah, the beginning of the movie, they're actually watching it in black and white in the kitchen. But when they move to a different room in the house, they have a color TV and suddenly it's in color.
Yeah.
So
that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. And then the last two things I watched were I did the Regal Mystery Movie on Monday, and it turned out to be Babes, which is a comedy that's, I think, coming out this weekend officially. What?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Yeah. About these two women. One is already a mother, and she's having another child. And then her friend, who's kind of like an arrested development person, who suddenly gets pregnant, and now she has to go through having a child, and she is definitely not ready for it. And she leans on her friend who has had kids, and it kind of implodes their friendship, and it's it's like raunchy as hell. But according to them, like, it's a pretty accurate portrayal of real life for them. And then, yeah, I thought it was fun. It's not like, you know, the best comedy I've ever seen, but compared to like what's out there, I was like, wow, like someone's still trying to be edgy with this, and not like an edgelord way. So yeah, I had fun. Although as soon, I got there a little bit late, so I missed maybe a minute of the opening. And as I was walking in, two older people were walking out. It's right away. It's pretty filthy.
Right on. Yeah, I haven't seen Bottoms from last year either, but it sounds like that there's a raunchy comedy comeback kind of slowly emerging, which I enjoy seeing that happen. So,
yeah. Bottoms is a little more like zany fun, where this is just more like dirty and real.
Pretty and grounded. Okay.
Yeah. Like a lot of the comedy is just the dialogue, you know, it's not like there's a lot of sight gags like Bottoms has.
All right. But still got the punch factor. Maybe that's the key thing that I'm honing in on.
Yeah. And the last thing I watched was Chris Pine's directorial debut, Pool Man.
Oh, how was it?
It was just kind of blah. I told someone else, it's basically, if it feels like an inside joke where two friends decided, hey, what if Chinatown was a comedy and... the comedy was very niche to us, and Jake Gittes was a neurotic working through his trauma.
Okay.
While being an unlicensed detective. It's very like, the whole time I was just like, what is this movie trying to do? I know it's clearly loves Chinatown. It's exactly Chinatown. In the movie, they confess that they're basically doing Chinatown. So I'm just like, I don't know why definitely a friends helping friends movie got made. Like, who is this for other than the people who made it?
You know, though, I haven't seen it yet, obviously, but I did read an article where Chris Pine was kind of like reacting to the negative reaction of the film, and he kind of just said like, I'm proud of this thing. I don't care what.
Yeah, I saw the headlines like, did I make a piece of shit? People are telling me I made a piece of shit, but No, I love this. I made this. This is good.
Yeah.
That's all that matters.
Attitude makes me want to watch the movie, regardless of whether or not I like it or not. I appreciate that attitude.
Yeah, I saw the trailer. It looked fun. So I was like, yeah, give it a shot. And then like the people, the Esquire said like, we left 40 minutes in and we work here. So I was like, oh, it's a dumpster fire. And I still got to watch it. And then I watched it. I was like, it's not even like a dumpster fire. It's just kind of like, meh. Okay. It's competent. There's a story here, but the story is Chinatown, so not original. Like, yeah, even the twists and turns are Chinatown, but then there's just parts like, whatever the pool man's real name is, we'll say pool man, Chris Pine's character, he jumps on a like Vespa scooter and rides around with like a gold helmet and a cape. Like, okay, he's evading the cops. Hilarious.
You know, it's funny, when I saw the trailer for it, I wouldn't even have thought Chinatown, because of his look and design. I thought it was like, is this kind of like Big Lebowski if it was a little bit more cohesive and less ambiguous, like, or like less of a Raymond Chandler novel? Like, that sounds fun, I guess. I'd be down to see it. Sounds like, though, apparently it's kind of just there.
Yeah.
Should watch Chinatown again before I watch the pool man, see which one's better.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that's different is like, yeah, he's a guy who lives in a trailer at a motel and works on the pool. He's the aquatics guy, and then he gets roped in. He's trying to get trolleys installed into Los Angeles to improve transportation, quote a la Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Bring those back. They say that in the movie. And literally the plot is someone stealing water from Los Angeles for their own personal benefit. And so he has to figure out how to stop that. And he thinks it's the Stephen Tobolowsky's character, the main councilman, but you know, it's not that far removed. So yeah, it's like, okay, why does this have to be a pool guy? I don't know. Like,
I don't know.
Yeah. And Danny DeVito and Annette Bening are his parents, but you're like, the whole movie, you're like, is Danny DeVito his real dad or is like an adoptive father? Like, Annette Bening doesn't treat him like her son, but she like doesn't say he's her son, but she acts like it because she's also like his therapist. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And,
like, Danny DeVito's trying to make a movie of the whole thing while it's going on. Yeah. I don't know.
Fair enough.
And that's what I watched this week.
What are you guys going to watch next week?
Well, Zach, Ryan has informed me that our movie of the week for next week is The Strangers, chapter one. I think it's part one, whatever.
Chapter one. There's three chapters to this book. Rennie Harlan's put together a trilogy.
I don't know what my hang up is on like using chapter as like a movie term, because that's like for books for me. But
I don't know. But I mean, Quentin Tarantino's done it before, so maybe it works. I'm actually shocked that he doesn't want to see If by John Krasinski, but maybe that's just maybe he has his reasons. Who knows?
They could have called it The Original Strangers, maybe, or something like that. But no, they went with Chapter One.
The Strange. And then yeah. It goes into Ers.
The Stranger. Then the sequel's The Strangers.
Strangest.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, totally. The Strange Trilogy. Strange, Stranger, Strangers.
Somewhere Kevin Feige is having a heart attack by us stealing his quote unquote IP.
So yeah, that's what we'll be watching next week. So
cool.
Keep it real, nerds.
Yeah.
Well, a real nerd knows who shot a real nerd.
Thanks for listening to Real Nerds Podcast, a Nebulous Visions production. Stream or download episodes, read articles at realnerdspodcast.com. Stream us on Apple or Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or iHeartRadio. Follow us on Facebook, Real Nerds Podcast. Twitter and Instagram, at Real Nerds. Watch us on YouTube, Real Nerds Podcast. Email us at realnerds@gmail.com. Call us at 720-6NERDS5. Thank you to Sparks Mandrill, Mike at Plan 9 Studios, and Bolognium for all of our groovy theme songs. And that's how you fucking do it!